Welcome to Indigenized Connections on Air, a podcast brought to you by the University of Minnesota Extension Center for Community Vitality in the area of leadership and civic engagement, and also by the Minnesota Indigenous Leadership Network, which explores the issues that impact tribal communities and leadership throughout Minnesota. I'm your host, Jason Schlender, and I'm the American Indian Leadership and Civic Engagement Educator. My guest today is from the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, a former chemical dependency coach and former commissioner of natural resources for the Mille Lacs Band. He is currently the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources tribal liaison. Please welcome Bradley Harrington Jr., also known as Najikia Wasung, to the podcast.
My name, Andrew.
Our focus, as I've mentioned, is resiliency. So, tell us about your leadership journey.
Looking back, you could connect the dots on how you came to be in your current situation, right? But like right now, it's really tough to see what those dots are. But 10 years from now, we're all going to be able to look back and see what we're doing right now that contributed to ourselves. So, a number of things contributed to mine. Looking back, of course, growing up on the reservation, the way my grandparents were and everything that I learned from them. The male role models was a little bit of a tough one for me, but I did have a positive male role model in my uncle. Eventually society and my self-identity faltered and I succumbed to addiction and criminality. But I like to start my leadership journey in 2010. I was about 1 year into a five-year prison sentence where I was serving 3.5 years, and had a little awakening in there, and then switched to Ojibwe culture and spirituality approach while I was in treatment. So really tried to find out who I was as an Anishinaabe person. Of course, I knew the language was important, so spent time on language, of course, history. History was another important one, and I knew the cultural teachings were going to be pretty important too, so I knew I needed to figure that out. So I worked on myself, my inner thought process and beliefs of who I am as a human being, and as I was moving that stuff out, I was trying to replace it with Anishinaabe thoughts and perspectives. When I got out in 2012, August 1st of 2012, I got out, and my only motivation was to do better in my community. So I went to places I normally wouldn't, like community meetings, hung out at the government center, ceremonial, because I was trying to learn Ojibwe, so I had to go to where the language was at. So I went to ceremonies, and I started getting involved with cultural revitalization, Ojibwe language revitalization, and kind of found my way in there, learned some, and started getting ideas. I was trying to go to college at the time too. I knew that I had to do something different, and in order to do something different, I had to do different and be a part of different things that I normally would in my community. I stopped hanging around with a lot of my family. A lot of my family still uses. They actually had a bet going on when I was going to violate and end back in prison. I got out August 1st. The longest somebody had me going was by Christmas. So that was about like 4 months. A lot of the people closest to me thought I would be back in prison within 4 months. So I didn't find that out till after. But being a part of different things, meeting new people, taking part in leadership programming, such as the Blandin Reservation Community Leadership Program. Also, I was in the Native Nation Rebuilder Dropout. I didn't make it. It's one of the things that I really regret not finishing off was that. I'm training, but I got what I got, and I have to use it to the best that I can. But since then, and everything else leading up on my leadership journey was when I started formulating ideas on what was Anishinaabe natural resources. I was going to college for natural resources at the time. I was learning Anishinaabe language and culture also, and what I was learning in college was really conflicting with what I was learning in the cultural area from the elders. I hung out with four elders, Larry Smallwood, Doug Sam, Joe Naquin-Aidy, and Lee Staples. Spent a lot of time with them because all my homies thought I was going back to prison, so I stopped hanging out with them. Went and started hanging out with these old guys that, no, they, I don't know, must have seen something in me enough to spend some time with me and teach me a few things. But I started approaching our chief executive, Melanie Benjamin. I go visit with her, pitch to her ideas on Anishinaabe natural resources. This is what our DNR should be doing. I wish we had more programming for reentry. We can spend our net revenue a little bit better if we invest more cultural programming in the youth. So in 20 years, when they grow up, we wouldn't need so much in band member legal aid or chemical dependency. And I was a big, you know, cultural pusher with our band assembly too. And I started getting noticed in the community for my recovery work and the pushing of culture and language. I got a grant before to do a language class, and that went pretty good. It was a one-time deal though. But I remember 2017, I think it was, Larry Smallwood passed away, and that was my second teacher to pass away in about a year and a half. So Doug Sam went about a year and a half before him, and then Larry Smallwood passed, and so I went out and fasted. And you know, before that time, within about 6 months of that time, I was talking with the chief about natural resources, Anishinaabe natural resources. I went and fasted, got out, came out from that, and about a week later, Joe Naquin-Aidy Sr.'s wife passed away. So, you know, to support my Niji, one of my teachers that I still have left, I went to the funeral. And it was at the funeral where I was sitting near Melanie Benjamin and started talking to her more about, you know, Anishinaabe natural resources. That was on a Friday. She called me in on a Monday if I would bring a plan together for the DNR and if I was interested in being the commissioner for Department of Natural Resources for the Mille Lacs Band. I asked her if I could take the weekend to think about it. You know, I thought I was going to be spending 10 years just being a cultural student. And, you know, I thought I was just going to spend 10 years doing that, you know, coming straight out of fast. So Monday I went and visited her. I brought a plan. I brought my aspects of Anishinaabe natural resources. One, it's given by the Money Doug. Two, it enhances and sustains life. And three, it contributes. It's a part of a spiritual belief system. It works if you believe it works. And even in some instances, it's there. It's like an ecosystem. It's its own spiritual ecosystem. So those are my three criteria for Anishinaabe natural resources. So talking to her about it, and I was like, well, obviously there's deer, wild rice, maple sap, fish. And then I was like, the language has to play a part in it too, because we can't even transfer the energy without the language. So I think I said something like the language is the Wi-Fi that connects everything all together. It encompasses everything and holds the shape of a spiritual ecosystem. She must have bought it, because she nominated me the next day. The following week I had about a two and a half hour confirmation hearing. So I went in front of our band assembly, which is like our legislature, and they had a whole packet of questions that they're just going down, and I answered, you know, the best of my ability. I didn't try to act like I knew everything. I just went in there, been myself, because if I didn't make it, I'd still be me. I'd still learn in language, contributing to my community. If I did make it, I'd still be me, but I'd have a little bit more authority and responsibility. And at that point in my life, I was also spiritually charged from fasting that the Money Doug are going to have their way anyway. So it's really not up to me. I just got to occupy space for a little bit while the money do guide me through a system. So I was nominated and confirmed all within about a week and a half. So from when I was asked, which was on a Friday, nominated on a Tuesday, confirmed I think the following Thursday, and then sworn in 2 weeks later. Really rapid, kind of took me by surprise. I wasn't expecting that like a month before, but I believe that the money do put me in that position and I was going to be well guided through it. So I served for 2.5 years. You know, here's some good things, you know, make some mistakes. No one's perfect. We still got to occupy a flawed human existence. I believe that it wasn't without reason. You know, I learned from it. My community learned from it. I'm hoping other people learn from some of the mistakes that I made. And then when we started talking, when Peggy Flanagan got in as lieutenant governor, I was on the consultation for the DNR's tribal liaison, and I was worried about who they were going to hire in on that position, like who we'd get, who's the DNR going to get, right? It's really not our, they say that we're the friends and everything and we're supposed to be a partner in preserving this, but I always seen them as adversarial. And then some other tribal liaisons, I get really concerned when the tribal liaison is not a tribal member. So that's always concerning to me. The other one was, if it is a tribal member, are they from the area? Because I view that a tribal liaison to connect with a tribe of this region would work better if it was a member of a tribe from that's being affected. They got, you know, they got some skin in the game, right? So when the talk came up that if I was interested, we hemmed and hawed and worked ideas out from October through December until I kind of agreed to it at the end of December, and then we worked out the details and I resigned from the commissioner of the Mille Lacs Band Department of Natural Resources on January 24th. The state was trying to get me to take a couple weeks off for a little transition inner, but I said no, my resignation date is on a Friday. I'm coming straight to you guys that Monday, so I'll be down there Monday. So January 27th, I started with the state. A month after that, we got hit with the COVID pandemic. Right when I was getting into it, people were getting used to me. They're still getting used to my character. The way Anishinaabe make a point, I noticed, is a lot different than the Chimookamon. Yeah. And the way the Anishinaabe work, hold up interpersonal relations, is a lot different than how the Chimookamon does. So right when they're getting used to me, I had to start hollering them, talking them through emails and Skypes and Zooms. So that's kind of my leadership, just like a quick timeline of my journey. Been since 2012, from a recent release convicted felon coming back to my community to holding some air, some weight by 2015. By 2017, I must have established myself long enough to be worthy of trust again. Didn't use, didn't drink, helpful and about as non-judgmental as someone can get. You know, I'm not saying that it's completely not there, because there's times where I find myself diving into that, but yeah, it seemed really fast, really fast. Well,
yeah, I mean, I think it's you're a strong example of, you know, for especially tribal people, you know, that people that have been impacted by, you know, things beyond their control. Sometimes we're victims to the environment that we're within. And so it's, your journey, the things that you've encountered, but also your resilience. And this is kind of like where, you know, we're focused on resilience here today. But when we think about resilience, it's, you know, it's something that we hold up in our communities and in our people. And so you've mentioned, you know, some key people in your life, some elders that instilled in you knowledge and teachings. But if you could maybe just elaborate on them, and especially, you know, when we think of, you know, a lot of our elders that have passed away, you know, rest in peace to Doug and to Larry Smallwood, make huge foundations of knowledge and language and culture. If you could just speak just a little bit about their influence, you know, more specifically to resilience and how you've those key times in your life where you needed to draw upon that inner resilience?
Well, with Doug, Larry, Joe, and Obazan, I've known them for a long time. You know, Joe was one of the elders in my community, so is Doug. And Larry was one of those community elders that made his way around every place and, pretty quick to cast a teaching or a joke or a dirty story. One of the two, but they all had a reason. Something to learn from. So Doug, I remember him when I was a kid. It was seeming like we were just not really ignored, but you know, the old people were out doing old people stuff and then young people were doing all the kid stuff. But I remember Doug, he would always be one to say hi to me for whatever reason, right? There's this really cool old man always say hi and whatnot, and I was like, cool, and, I didn't really think about that until I was hanging out with him a lot. And I was like, man, this guy's a pretty cool guy. And without the four of them, spending time with me in one of my most vulnerable times, I had any success in anything, I probably would have eventually gave up due to a lack of any connections. Loneliness plays a big role. Purposeless, because you don't have any connections, you're not doing anything, so you're wondering what your purpose is. Without them being there and filling some time and making it like extremely worthwhile, I think that some of the stuff I do remember is only a small amount of what I was told by those guys. And I wish I had a recorder going, but then even more than that, I wish I had my own mind right going for the 15 years or so that I was acting up, because now I'm missing out on a lot of data that could have been introduced and then reinforced through my own thought process without having to hope that I get something recorded or written down. Obazan, I remember my first time seeing him was late 90s, and I can't remember whose funeral it was, but that was one of the first times I picked up on Obazan. I can remember the way he talked was a little bit different than how some of the Mille Lacs guys spoke. And then in 2005, I was in prison for the first time, and I was still wild. I didn't care about not a goddamn thing back then, but I wanted to be cool and do my intro right. And so I didn't know what my name was. I forgot it for a long time. I just knew some syllables of it. So I went up to him. Obazan was coming into the prison in Rush City and doing some sweats for us. I went up to him and I was like, hey, I forgot my Ojibwe name, but it's something like Nushgewasa, something like that. I can't remember the exact syllables I used. And then I remember he starts nodding and saying, he was, oh yeah, Nushgewasa, I know that name. And I was like, all right, cool. And he was like, yeah, there's a couple of them over in the Mille Lacs area that was named that. I started using that name, and then the tobacco. So this kind of goes back into Anishinaabe Natural Resources, right? I was using my name, which is given by the money Duke enhances, sustains life, is supported by a spiritual belief system. I was using a Sema, which is the act of a Sema K, is given by money Duke enhances, sustains life, and is supported by spiritual belief system. So I was doing that, right? And I kept on doing that. By the time I went to prison again, it was 2010, 5 years, I've been using my name and tobacco on and off. And I think that gave me enough inner strength, enough support, enough connection to where I had the revelation in 2010. I was able to recognize it and I was able to act on it. So I don't, and then getting out in 2012 and hanging out with Obazan more, expanding my idea on Anishinaabe spiritualism, connected with all the practical applications that Joe Senior talks about, and then Doug's cultural practices that he would talk about, it all kind of wrapped up and came together. So without having that connection introduced to me when I was a kid, by my grandparents, reinforced a bit by some of the elders in the community, meeting Obazan in 2005, get my name figured out to get my connection a little bit stronger. It feels like I jumped from dial-up speed straight to 5G in the last 5 years. So it was pretty amazing. I'm glad that those guys spent time with me. I probably wouldn't have been able to do anything without it.
Well, I mean, it's just a testament to those, you know, to those elders too, because they are, I knew Doug through Glyphwick, through his work was on the Voight Task Force, Intertribal Task Force. But, you know, obviously, you know, we all had our own connections and relationships with Omic and Obazan and Joe. You know, the one thing I think that really stands out with them is just their patience, because I think that's the biggest, one of the biggest things is being able to, it's intimidating to try to bridge the connection between, you know, our peer group, our generation to, you know, to older generations, like what do we have in common, you know, and how do we even maintain relationships? Because I think about the first time I ever met Obazan, he was at our big drum ceremony back home and he had a Pelly Pell jacket on. And I was thinking, I'm a hip hop guy too. And I'm thinking, what's this old man wearing this old Pelly Pell jacket for? You know, it's like something. There's no way he could be like, listen to rap music or anything like that. You know, I just thought it was just something that just kind of caught my eye, you know. And he had, you know, obviously had been there with people we know and, you know, and stuff like that. But it was just, that was a person that draw my attention. And then obviously, you know, a Mick, you know, just probably one of the coolest looking, Ojibwe's ever, you know, with his hairstyle and cowboy boots and the way he dressed, the way he talked, obviously influential in the way that he, just took the time to really, you know, and, you know, it's hard to speak from his work before, but I think with the group that he worked with before he passed away, you know, I think he was really proud of, kind of the progression of language revitalization. So yeah. And then Joe is fortunately, you know, we're fortunate to still have Joe with us. And, you know, Joe's always traveling everywhere, combat veteran, and his quiet demeanor and patience, you know, he's just, you know, he's obviously someone that, those are all those traits and things that many of us have benefited from. Yeah. So when we think of those, those teachings, those elders, you know, that are, you know, one thing I want to do is probably should explain to our listeners here too, you know, it's, a lot of times we, we're so immersed in our culture. A lot of times, you know, some of the words that we share are common to us, may not be common to our listeners though. So, a word like Niji just kind of is just a common reference to someone like your fellow person or your fellow man or a fellow woman, like a friend, commonly known as a friend. Manidu is a reference to the spirit, you know, a spiritual entity or a spiritual being. And Manidug, as Brad had referenced, is just a pluralization collection or the group of spirits that, you know, play a part in, you know, in overseeing and kind of playing their part in taking care of the creator's children and environment. And so just some clarity on that, I guess, because if some people are listening, like may not understand some of the Ojibwe terminology that we've used here today. So then we as you mentioned, you know, you're 1 month in, about a month in, and then all of a sudden the COVID-19 quarantine, you know, with the Governor Walz issuing those executive orders to kind of shut everything down. People stay at home, practice social distancing, you know, wash your hands, you know, take care of yourselves and the best way that you can so it can stop the spread. But it has impacted many of us and how we work. You know, it has affected our spirituality too in some way too, because we're not able to gather ceremonially like we usually do. But thinking of those of that COVID-19 quarantine, it's brought amongst us some challenging times. So how have you coped challenges during this quarantine?
Yeah, so fortunate enough for me is right at the beginning of the quarantine, it started, it was the beginning of sapping season. So I sap just roughly half a mile from my house. So it was easy enough for me. So dedicated my time to gathering sap. A lot of my work also is remote, so I was still able to work off my computer and Zoom meetings and Skype meetings and definitely more phone calls, because I like to try to be present physically as much as I can, especially when trying to build, you know, like a strong working relationship with somebody. So somebody that I know that I'm going to be working with for a while, I'll try to spend physical time with them. People that are just like a bounce in every once in a while requesting a little bit of info, we can do that through email and a phone call. But people that I'm going to be working closely with, I like getting in there with them, because I'm introverted in some sense, but when that part of it goes that where I'm working in an area of interest, then I let that go a little bit. So if I'm working with somebody that has a common theme, common focus, common goals, it's a lot easier to open up. But so sapping season, we went and tapped a 20 trees, and me and my boys and one friend. I didn't allow a lot of people to come over to my place to boil, so just me, my two boys, and a friend of mine spent the time out there boiling. And then as we're boiling, we'll tell stories to the boys and talk and try to demonstrate, you know, good man-to-man interpersonal skills, right? Because from when I got growing up, all dudes were an adversary, not to be trusted. And, you know, it was really tough times around here when I was growing up. But in order to demonstrate, you know, good working with your friends, my boys are there, of course, seeing that. And hopefully that's demonstrated through that. And I think that's why the Anishinaabe culture was able to function so well over a long period of time. Because let's say if I were to pick a fight with my buddy, his name's Mike. If I were to pick a fight with my buddy and we stop hanging out over some little stuff that our egos are a little bit too big to reconcile. Now I got to split all the wood, right? I got to boil all the sap my goddamn self. He's not coming over to help. So it gives a little bit of a clarity on adjusting your relationship, picking your battles, and being able to have your own opinion, but still working on our common cause, which was sapping. Our goal was to produce as much syrup and candy and sugar as we can with what we get, and we stayed aligned on that. And the other part of it is the funerals haven't stopped here also, so I take part in the ceremonial, that part of the ceremonial aspect in my community. We go and do the crowd's gotten smaller, encouraging people not to come fill up a whole gymnasium. And I've got conflicted there for Big Drum. Big Drum coming up, and our drum chief said that we're going to continue on and have the Big Drum ceremonies. So my faith says that go, because that's what the Big Drums are for, to protect us and get that teaching from Joe. The other part of the faith is we're being warned that there's something dangerous out there. Do we just jump out there and hope on faith alone? Or do we try to understand our physical limitations? And the other one is just because the warning is coming from the white man doesn't mean that it's not dangerous. So to err on the side of caution, because I got babies at home, a pregnant woman that's on the verge of giving birth, do I want to go out there and be exposed to something unnecessarily, knowing that I have physical limitations as a human being? I've been staying out of the dance hall and the best I can out of large public areas.
So how are you staying busy at home? I know for myself, you know, it's my kids are kind of getting antsy, you know, like they can't just go to the, you know, go outside and play basketball and congregate with their friends. So they get kind of restless soon. So we're just, you know, trying to be creative and trying to utilize their energy in a positive way. And so sometimes we get outside for a little bit, you know, and it's like, I've already been out, you know, to gun spearing and done some things already. But, you know, with your kids, you got some young ones there too with a lot of energy. And how are you adapting to the, you know, some of those stay-at-home orders?
Yep. So we got a not a, a schedule going, but there's a rotation. So if the kids seeming that they need to go someplace else, then they go to places where they know, and I know that they're isolating too. They're not just out recklessly running around town. So today I got four of them at home. They're doing their homework, so that helps keep them busy a little bit. Well, we just finished sapping too. We just had our last boil. Well, it feels like a month ago, but it was just a few days ago. We boiled down. So we got a new evaporator. My big kettle broke. So
How did that happen?
Man, I think they dropped it.
Oh.
And then they told me about it. They told me about it, and I put it away, and then I forgot about it. The day we went and set taps, I started getting my kettles and my fire pit ready. It was still snowy here. And then went to my big kettle, and I was like, holy crap, man, there's a big crack on it. And then I was like, oh, god dang it, they dropped it last year when they're finishing rice. So I have another kettle. So my big kettle was 30 gallons. I was able to hold 30 gallons. My small kettle is 15, so it's half the size. So I was like, man, we only got 20 taps set. We should be able to do all that in a small kettle. So we did the first couple runs in the small kettle, and it was dumping sap. And we're like, holy crap. And so that was keeping us busy a lot, was going out and collecting sap. And then we were having to boil a lot. I was like, I need to find another kettle. And no one's selling kettles at this time. I couldn't find one. I found one like down in Iowa, and I was like, man, we're going down here for a goddamn kettle. So I was like, man, let me check out these evaporators. And, you know, because I try to stay close to what the ancestors did, but the other part of me says, man, my ancestors would have been, why didn't you get the evaporator, man? It works so much more efficiently. You're saving on wood and cuts your time down in half. And so I found an evaporator in my area up by the Crosby area, which is about 30 miles from here. Got the evaporator, and yeah, we're able to do twice as much, twice as fast. So what we were able to do in 2 days, we were able to do double that in 1 day. So our last boil, nice. We really pushed a limit. Our last collection was like one of the biggest collections. We got 50 gallons of sap in about a day and a half. On 20 taps. So the frogs were croaking that day when we went to go get the sap. So we're like, poof, frogs are finally croaking. We thought they'd never be here. So we pulled the taps that day too. And yeah, so brought it all home. And then we're like, all right, well, tomorrow, let's go for it, man. Let's boil all this. And yeah, we did. We made it. We started the fire about 9 in the morning. And then got it down to some really dark tea, about like 9 at night, 50 gallons.
Maybe expand a little bit on what you said about the frogs. Like, explain that to our listeners, what that means. It's interesting.
It was a teaching I got from Doug. So a lot of my cultural practices, the activity themselves, I learned from Doug, the ricing and the sapping. Because when it starts getting late in the season, the sap the spoils really quick, and even it'll come out of the tree like already warmed up and not really spoiled, but a little bit milky. So I asked him, I was like, is there a timer on Anishinaabe new to pull the taps without having to sit there and wait and let a whole bunch collect a whole bunch of, if you got 100 taps set out and that's a lot of taps go down because you didn't know, right? You see it dripping and it's cloudy, then you have to go and dump everything. So I asked, when did the Anishinaabe, when did they know when to pull their taps? And he said, well, when the frogs croak. And when the frogs croak, that means that the earth warmed up enough, all the roots are warm enough for the frogs to wake up, which means that your sap is going to be iffy. So whenever the frogs croak, I'll pull it. And he also said the frogs croaking in this area would also signify that the ice is going to get ready to pull away from the shore. So you pull your taps and you get your spearing stuff ready when the frogs croak.
Yeah, that's pretty much similar for us too. You know, it's like we once we hear the spring peepers, it's time to, you should already be ready to go.
Yeah.
You should have your gear ready to, you know, that's the, and it's, you know, right along the same lines as your, what you're saying, you know, things are starting to warm up, water's warming up, mm-hmm. you know, the earth is warming, you know, so that's a change in season. So I wanted to kind of reflect back on your past. You know, it's I think you know, your experiences, the things that you've endured, you know, speak a lot to you know, your resiliency, you know, and also contribute to your leadership style, right? But thinking of like those things that you've encountered, how you've dealt with adversity.
Well, what I'd like to say is that I met adversity with, you know, all my force and all my weight and everything behind it, and I knocked him flat on his butt. But, you know, it's almost like a case-by-case basis, you know. Adversity, being in prison and trying to do things different while in there, you know, you catch some flack for trying to be good, right? In this environment that's just full of negativity, you go try start and, you know, be good and have a different perspective. You know, it's like having to hold back the pride and the ego in an area where the pride and the ego leads everything. So while I was in prison, I was still there. So I up until April, so it's just been about 11 years. It was 11 years April 5th where I haven't been high or used any drugs since. So it's been 11 years. But I say it's really been 10 years because I actually chose to stay that way April of 2010. Up until then, I was going to stay the same. I was going to just continue on doing what I'm doing, finish my time, get out, and, you know, just kind of happy I made it to 30. But when I changed, I met with the adversity in the Native group in the prison, you know, getting all the soft and, you know, just a whole bunch of other names. And, you know, in that case, I was, but I was still ready to throw down. So, you know, it wasn't really nothing to it. When I came home from your own family, it's tough. Having to turn your back on them and stay away from them. And then they call your names. One of my brothers, I remember meeting up with him, and, you know, I was avoiding almost everybody. You know, it's tough when everybody, we all live within like a mile and a half of each other here. But I remember seeing him, you know, I was being short with him. You know, I wasn't trying to hang out. I wasn't trying to be buddy-buddy anymore because I still knew what he was up to. But when I remember one time met up with him and being short with him, and then he was like, you know what, man, you forgot where you came from. And I was like, oh, man, you know, I still care about them. You know, they're still my family. But I remember when he said that to me, you know, I immediately got, you know, angry and sad and questioning myself. I was like, man, am I really turning my back on? Because this dude is my brother. We had, you know, it was my cousin, but, you know, we grew up as brothers. And he's saying that I forgot where I came from. So I got mad at him, and I was like, no, man, I remember exactly where I came from. That's why I'm the way I am today. You know, I just spun around. I was like, whatever. Thinking on that, you know, that's the adversity I was getting from my family when I changed. And thinking that I did the right thing, you know, I was protecting myself, my own sanity, my own recovery, my family, you know, the family unit I was trying to build. You know, I knew he couldn't have a place in it. But then when we buried him, like a year and a half ago, was it? He died of an OD. Mm. And I was like, looking back, I was like, what if I didn't avoid him so much? What if I didn't avoid my family so much? What if I tried to be a positive part of it? You know, this is the only stuff you could think looking back. Yesterday, buried his brother yesterday, OD, and, you know, fresh off of that, thinking, well, was there more that I could do? So I reached out to our other brothers and sent him a message saying, you know what? You know, I really care about you guys, but just send me a wave or a little message or something. Just let me know that you guys are okay out there, or if you need anything, because you know, burying all these guys now that I grew up with is tougher than seemingly anything else right now. And so when people talk to me about my work with the state, yeah, it's tough, right? Yeah, it's all tough. But nothing's tougher than burying your brother. Nothing's tougher than staying away from all these people who are questionable in your life, and then you're burying them. You know, that's the toughest part of it. But I rely back on all the old guys. They're really consistent in saying that everybody's here for a reason, and it's not anyone's place to try to figure that out for them. They're there, and the Money Dew are helping them regardless of what condition that they're in. They're out there using the Money Dew, are still helping them. They're straightening up, the Money Dew are helping them. They're seemingly not getting any help, but, you know, maintaining, you know, the worker that's working day to day, but still living a tough life, they're, the Money Dew are still helping them. So bringing all that to my state job, I'm there. I'm not there to cater to their perspectives and agree that thinking that they're right. I'm definitely not there for that. I'm there because of what I know. Up in my head, and what I share, you know, and what I can express to help guide them. And that's the next adversity. Tribal, on the tribal side, I'm actually in it with them, because there's an ordinance and a couple policies tribally that prevents me from working in any recovery field, the background check. There we have a treatment center. The Mille Lacs Band does, called Four Winds Treatment Center. It's in Brainerd, Minnesota. They took over in 2017 or 2016. When it was with the state, it was a state treatment center. I was allowed to work there. They gave me a waiver of my background and allowed me to work there. The day that the Mille Lacs Band took over my tribe, the day they took over, I couldn't work there anymore. I was there as a spiritual advisor. You know, I'd help out the guys. And I'd work with the gals a little bit, but I tried to encourage the treatment center to bring in a gal to work with the girls so I could just work with the guys. But there's that adversity, you know, being a felon, trying to work and trying to help my own tribe. There's some positions that my experience, my passion, and some of my knowledge can really help, but I can't do it because of a background check. And the other one is I can't run for public office in an election, because you can't have been convicted of a felony and hold a chairman or a representative or a treasurer spot for my tribe. But I can for the American government. And so I say that, and I was like, so I'm good enough to be a state rep. I can run for governor. I can run for president of the United States, but I'm not good enough to run for representative of my own tribe. Why? Because you guys want to, they want it, for whatever reason, they put that in place, but it's limiting the community's voice on leaders determining what leader the band members can vote for. So I fall into that one as well. So I'm currently running for an American government seat, Mille Lacs County Commissioner of District 5, which pretty much my whole reservation. It's just having that idea out there that having a felony means you're less of a member, to the point you can't even represent people. I'm sure there's going to be very few people that actually get the urge to run for tribal government, but just knowing that it's there stunts people in general.
Through our conversation today, you talked about the influence of your elders and, you know, their impact. Someday you'll be there too, you know, thinking about the importance of transferring knowledge, you know, to the younger generation. So as you reflect on your own leadership journey, what advice do you have for the, you know, those aspiring young leaders out there?
Oh, I'd like to think about, I wish I did, but, you know, everything that I did helped me become who I am today. But it's stuff that I wish I knew, or stuff that I wish I pursued a little bit more. For aspiring young leaders out there, whenever I talk to a younger group, I always tell them to seek out the teachings. And, you know, in times like today, that's a bit tough, because there's a few people that have teachings to give now, right? We're getting to a point to where some of our more able elders don't speak Ojibwe, don't practice the customs, don't, some of them really don't even believe in the Ojibwe spirituality. So it's really tough today to say, go to your elders. We got to be pretty specific, man. Go talk to Joe if you want to know that. Go talk to Obazan if you want to know that. I would tell them also is that, you know, their educations that they're getting now, it's all going to come into work if they have the cultural knowledge to tie it to. There was a time where I was like strictly going straight college, and I was like, yep, I'm going to go to college and come back and help my people, which is some people's paths. I was aware enough and able to make a decision to the when, I think it was springtime of 2016 maybe, where I decided I'm not going to go to college anymore. I'm going to spend all my time pursuing Ojibwe language, culture, and ceremony, just about everything I can't get in college, because the college is always going to be there, but these elders weren't. So when I'm, and that's some people's past, that's not everybody's, but just to rely on language and general cultural teachings, use your tobacco every day, use your name every day with it, connecting the dots backwards. If I didn't start doing that in 2005 to show off, I probably wouldn't have gained a connection strong enough to recognize a door opening in my favor 5 years later while sitting in prison. So use your name, use your tobacco, language, and whatever teachings you got. So right now there's a, you know, a lot of things going on. We're trying to figure out how to stay connected digitally from far away, how to continue on with programs, with initiatives when everybody's being asked to stay home and stay away from each other, how to plan throughout the day for a family the size of, man, 8. Sometimes here there's 10 and there's 10 of us. So how do we plan out our time? But I think when all this has already been all demonstrated for us, the Native American story, how to survive, basically, how to use what you got to continue on and maintain a sense of sanity. So I look back on what leaders from a long ago, how were their thought processes? They've been having to make crucial decisions in critical times since like 1700 through generations and centuries, and what did they always maintain as important? They always maintain that they have rights that they have as a people that were given by the creator, by the Great Spirit. The other one is you can see it in their discussions that they had values. They always referred to energy. They always referred to their people. It's very rare that you'll find a tribal leader saying, all right, I'll give you this much of my people's land if you kick me over a house or kick me over a money or whatever. They're always making decisions for the community as a whole with these values and these teachings attached to it. And today we're seeing that popping up right away, you know, like the money doer trying to teach us something. You know, it's not China went and started this big huge outbreak and it's all the Chumokamon's fault for doing industry or whatever. I believe that we're being put into a situation to learn, to get into a new sense of resilience. Like, how do we be contemporarily resilient with traditional values? There's more people out there seeking out traditional medicines now. There's more people, I think, you know, has a lot to do with lack of things to do, but they're out seeking some sort of knowledge. And I think, when all this is done, yeah, the virus is going to be a story. But there's another time in Anishinaabe history where this virus came and we got a jingle dress out of it. Mm. So 100 years from now, what are we going to say we learned that's going to be impactful for a century during this time of some contemporary traditionalism?
What's the next way you see tribal communities connecting through economic development?
Economic development. So I've tried and started some businesses I used to have a like a tree trimming, grass mowing, home repair, home maintenance type of business. So 2006, 2007, and 2008, you know, I cut down trees, install doors, patch walls, you know, just home maintenance type of guy. And I lacked the you know, the administrative knowledge then. So I didn't know how to plan and prepare, keep accurate records, you know, but I was also an addict and criminality at the time too. So that really didn't help. Today, I'm launching two businesses. One is a media, and it's stemming from what I learned in Blandon, and then ultimately what I learned in what I did get out of the Rebuilders program, is that tribes have the authority, but they need to seize it. Right now, our only business authority is to have a casino. There's some tribes out there that, you know, we do housing, and we get involved with other government businesses, right? The tribal government gets a business in order to generate revenue to take care of the people. But what I see here in Mille Lacs is, so we had a big boom early 90s, two casinos going up. So I remember where I live right now used to be the woods, and I used to play in. My grandma lived just up the road here, so I'm in a new community. There are dirt roads here. I think they said 80% poverty when I was in the 80s up to 1990, 91. 80% poverty. I didn't feel impoverished. You know, I didn't, you know, I didn't think it was bad. But businesses popped up. All the focus went on and on the casino, and it served its purpose. But now we built up this whole new group. They're turning, like, what, if you're born in 1990, you're now getting to be 30 years old, and all you knew was casino revenue. So now you're getting a more laid back, give it to me type of person, you know, waiting for the government to take care of everything type of person. But I think for economic development though now, well, one is connecting people back to who they are as Anishinaabe, their roles, strengths, character, spiritual energy. Knowing who they are would help them be a more productive member of the community, whether or not they do work or they do come over and cut your grass or fix your house, paint, sing, speak the language, do some sort of arts. The other part of it is, and I see it today in our businesses, in the Mille Lacs Band businesses, we got the casinos, of course, hotels, gas stations, printing companies, what else? Yeah. But though those types of businesses, I think, would be better off if they were owned and managed by a tribal member as opposed to a tribal government. It might have a little bit more effect, give an opportunity for one of our members to be a business owner and start putting that idea out there. The band bought a little resort. Let's see who some of our members are that would take on the lease, take on the responsibility, and take on the authority of having this business here, as opposed to letting it have the coming from the same overhead system that a really large casino does, because then you're eating up a lot of profits and putting on a lot of responsibility for this small resort or this little gas station to maximize profits, which is probably really only meant for either a company that owns 100 or so gas stations, or an individual person that owns one gas station. The opportunity for a band member to be a business owner as opposed to the government being a business owner. I think we can get involved in, then again, you're building up members. You need members to have a stake in the game other than election season. You need them to have their something going on to where they're responsible for something. Agriculture would be a good one right now. Our climate is shifting, and by the time we get a few agricultural families to get some intergenerational knowledge passed, because of climate change, we will be poised to really maximize our our ability in that area if we get a couple decades head start on it.
Yeah.
Because having it in the family gives it more, a little bit more gumption, a little bit more responsibility to your family and to your people. And there can be a trade-off there, because then we start looking into tribal economics again. Mille Lacs Band doesn't have enough land base to grow the variety of crop needed in order to feed the Mille Lacs people yet. That's given that we're still able to hunt, fish, and gather also. The other part of our economic engine, that's where we're just talking about growing food now at this point. So that's where I think some intertribal work can be done, is providing a variety of crops, but then at the same time figuring out how so here we can get an abundance of fish if our fish population holds, whereas up in the north they probably get a lot of good rice. So I wasn't able to rice last year because the water was too high, but other places were able to rice. I was able to fish last year because there was enough fish to go around, but in some places there wasn't. How are we able to get some sort of a tribal economic programming going based off of our own cultural harvesting?
As always, I appreciate, you know, your journey, you know, appreciate your work that you've done, and look forward to things in the future. So, miigwech niji, appreciate it.
Oh, miigwech niji, see you again.
Miigwech to Bradley Harrington Jr., Najke Awasung, for joining today's podcast. To learn more about the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe response to the COVID-19 pandemic, please visit MilleLacsBand.com/services/COVID-19-information. To learn more about leadership and civic engagement, go to extension.umn.edu/community-development/leadership-and-civic-engagement, where you will find more resources on growing leaders and strengthening leadership. Make sure to follow the Minnesota Indigenous Leadership Network on Facebook to stay up to date on research and resources for tribal communities and tribal leadership. We hope that you will join us again for a future episode of Indigenized Connections on Air.